Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, November 26, 2020. I'm your reader, Katie Carlton. Our first article for today's news section is LaPorte City Newspaper Closes After 127 Years, and this is by Christian Guess. LaPorte City. It's the end of an era. A family-owned LaPorte City publication that has been chronicling the town's history for more than 100 years has closed its doors. The Progress Review, first published September 30, 1893, was put to bed for the last time September 30, 2020. Mike and Jane Whittlesey of LaPorte City purchased the paper in 2002 from Robert and Doris Wagner, who ran the paper for 30 years. Jane Whittlesey, who is also the town's city clerk, took care of the financial side, while Mike Whittlesey operated as publisher, editor, and reporter. We very much enjoyed all 18 years of being part of the Progress Review's history, Mike Whittlesey said. They also own LaPorte City Printing and Design, which is still open for commercial printing. Whittlesey, now on the opposite end of an interview, fondly recalled memories of covering the town's highs and lows with the news pad and pen. He remembered celebrating with the town as he documented Union High School's football team winning its first state championship in 2011. He also mourned with the community as the search for a local teenager with autism ended in tragedy in 2018. Whittlesey describes the search for Jake Wilson as a dark cloud. As the local newspaper, we felt a deep obligation to treat the story with a little more care and respect for the difficulty the communities were going through. It wasn't a race to get that scoop. Our approach was different. The family is part of our community, part of our greater family, he said. While employees came and went, one employee stood the test of time. Mary Bauer, who still works with the couple, was the first person they hired. She did a little bit of everything, including photography, layout, and writing. If there was a sporting event in town, you could count on Mary being there taking some pretty awesome photos, Whittlesey said. Whittlesey cherishes the opportunities to learn about and make connections with his community. The couple successfully brought the historic newspaper to the digital age by creating its first website and app. It really comes down to telling people stories, he said. If you can communicate a story in a way where people can really walk away knowing someone better or understanding something better, that to me is journalism at its finest. Jolene Kronschnabel, director of Hawkins Memorial Library in LaPorte City, said the local paper and library have been a team for years. We will really miss the way the Progress Review preserved the history of the community, she said. Kronschnabel wrote a column on the library for the past 8 years. She also worked with Whittlesey on digitizing back issues of the Progress Review. The images can be viewed free of charge on the library's website, laportecity.lib.ia.us. It's such a loss of history, and you really realize that when you go to the digitized versions and look it all up. Anytime there was a celebration in town, it was recorded. And perhaps the paper's biggest star was a four-legged furry friend named Freckles. Now I will move to our next article. This article is titled, Interesting Things People Found in the Courier Archives. This is just a really short little section in the paper. Here's what people are uncovering in the Courier newspaper archives. Search our historical issues for obituaries, marriage, and birth announcements, social pages, and local sports. To see more and subscribe, visit https://wcfcourier.com/archives. Our next article is titled, Concerns Over Parking, Green Space, Sidewalk, Stall, Autumn Ridge Finalization in Cedar Falls. Cedar Falls. Neighbors and city staff expressed concerns with parking, green space, sidewalks, and drainage issues in Autumn Ridge. While the developer countered he didn't believe those issues should prevent him from finalizing the development. Developers with BNKD Real Estate Development, which has been developing Autumn Ridge near Union Road and West First Street in Western Cedar Falls since 2001, We're looking to finalize the master plan for the subdivision, as well as preliminary plans for their 9th and 10th editions of the subdivision. But city planner J.D. Attodaria said staff wanted to bring a few issues to the Planning and Zoning Commission on Tuesday before it is approved. The first issue is Autumn Ridge's excessive paving and curb cuts and the proposed design of the final two additions, which Attodaria said would add to street congestion, won't provide enough room for street parking, and compromises sidewalk continuity. City staff does not believe such models are good planning practice, Attodaria said, noting staff gave the developer a number of suggestions to improve it, such as garages behind the units accessible by alleyways. City code also requires the developer to complete the sidewalk connection along Union Road past Paddington Drive, which hasn't been done, Attodaria said. He also noted Autumn Ridge's new master plan did not include a lake with pedestrian trails as it had originally, and said the only green space in the development was private. The city's Parks and Recreation Department said a neighborhood park accessible to the community would be a good solution. A common, usable open space would enhance the livability of the community, Attodaria said. Autumn Ridge developer Dennis Happel with BNKD Real Estate said the subdivision's lake was taken out of the plan quite early, due in large part to what he called an uncontrolled runoff from farmland to the west. He also said previous conversations with former city staffers indicated he wouldn't have to extend the sidewalk himself, due to the parallel pedestrian trail across the street. We're not opposed to putting the sidewalk in. However, we feel the city should be responsible from the 5th edition boundary down to Paddington, Happel said. Happel also said putting in alleyways and changing the design would affect the price of the affordable housing he was trying to build, as well as take away from the backyards of the units. The on-street parking really isn't an issue. We don't believe the parking presents any kind of problem, he said. Jesse Meehan, who lives along nearby Berry Hill Road, said he was worried about increased drainage issues. We have some people on our street now who can't refinance their house without getting flood assurance, which is going to affect our property values, Meehan said. Doug Stanford, president of the Fieldstone Homeowners Association, said his board was also concerned about the increased additional housing density of the development's proposed 9th and 10th additions, which would add 96 new units to the area. We already have problems with congestion and speeding, Stanford said. Is it time to consider some changes in Union Road to allow for better traffic flow? Happel countered that drainage plans all muster with the city, which engineer Matt Tullen confirmed, and said Union Road traffic was in the city's hands. Commission members mostly agreed Happel would need to build the sidewalk and provide the green space, as the city staff had suggested, but they were divided on the parking issue. I'm concerned about all the driveways and the paving and the proximity of those, said Commissioner Leah Ann Saul. It does seem like a ton of pavement. Planning and Community Services Manager Karen Howard said solutions suggested by staff included units sharing driveways. There can be some creative solutions to all these issues, she said. Now I will go to our next article in the news section. This one is titled, Small Business Saturday Hopes to Bolster Waterloo Economy. And this is by Sydney Sison, Waterloo. Holiday pop-up shops and other small businesses are hoping to bolster the local economy for Small Business Saturday this weekend, encouraging spurring purchases from consumers. Downtown Economic Development Organization Main Street Waterloo said consumers have spent nearly $120 billion on the celebration dates since the event started in 2010. The event helps to support local jobs, conserve tax dollars, uplift entrepreneurship, establish the city as a desired destination, and help the environment, according to Main Street Waterloo. 8 holiday pop-up shops featuring 19 vendors will be open from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. on November 28th, December 5th, December 12th, and December 19th. The shops will be at the following locations: 614 Mulberry Street, 528 East 4th Street, 320 East 4th Street, 204 East 4th Street, 217 West 4th Street, 607 Sycamore Street, 627 Sycamore Street, and 217 West 6th Street. Other ways to support local businesses include liking social media posts, leaving positive comments, writing reviews, and telling friends about stores, Main Street Waterloo said on its Facebook page. We'll move to our next article. This one is titled November 25th COVID Update. 4 deaths added overnight in Black Hawk County, and this is by Amy Rivers. What to know today? Iowa's rate of coronavirus spread, a measure of how fast the virus is growing, was the lowest in the U.S. on Wednesday, 0.91, according to RT.live. When the value is below 1, the virus will stop spreading, according to the metric. Nonetheless, 3% of Iowa's total population were currently infected with coronavirus as of Wednesday. More than 7% of the state's residents have tested positive since March. Hospitalizations in Northeast Iowa and statewide dropped or remained flat Wednesday, though overall hospitalizations were up 51% over last week, and deaths were up 75%, according to the COVID Tracking Project. 4 deaths were added to Black Hawk County's total Wednesday, for a total of 131 people who have died of COVID-19 since March. Butler County also added 1 death, its second as many days, for a total of 5. Grundy County added 1 death for a total of 11. Fayette and Floyd counties each surpassed 1,000 cases in their counties Wednesday, tied at 1,002. That's 5.1% of Fayette County residents and 6.5% of Floyd County residents that have had the virus. The Dairy Suites at Western Home is Black Hawk County's latest long-term care facility outbreak, with 9 confirmed cases. The county now has 7 facilities in outbreak status. Creekside Living and Grundy Center is Grundy County's latest facility outbreak. Iowa is now recording an average of 21 deaths per day. The state recorded a high of 29 deaths on November 10th, November 12th, and November 19th. Another inmate has died at Anamosa State Prison. Frederick Lewis, 68, bringing that prison's total to 5 deaths. The test Iowa site in Waterloo will close for Thanksgiving Day, the governor's office announced. It will be open until 4 p.m. Wednesday and reopen on Friday from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. And then they have a graph here showing the coronavirus cases and 14-day average in Iowa, March 2020 through present. And it looks like today, 11-23, showing about 2,560 for the 14-day average cases. And says the total cases of coronavirus so far in Iowa have been 218,947. And then the average cases per day is 3,765, and that is down 18 within the last 14-day average. And the national ranking in cases per capita is 3rd, so there's been no change of that. And then the rate of spread is 0.91, so that has gone down by 6%. And then the positive testing rate yesterday was 22%. And it says, as of May 12th, the World Health Organization recommends a positive testing rate of 5% or lower for at least 14 days before normal activity resumes. And then the total number of deaths is 2,271, and that is the total number of people who died of the novel coronavirus beginning March 1st, 2020. And the average deaths per day is 21.6. And that is up by 1.4 in the 14-day average. And then the fatality rate is 1.04%, and that is up by 0.01%. And the national ranking in deaths per capita is 24th, and there's no change in that. The number of Iowans currently infected is 94,629. And that is up 956. The total population currently infected is 3%, and that is up 0.03%. And the total population ever infected is 7.09%, and that is up by 0.11%. And the hospitalized patients with COVID-19 statewide, there's about 1,305 hospitalized, and that's down by 46. RMCC Region 6 in Northeast Iowa is 313, so there's been no change there. And then RMCC Region 2, North Central Iowa, there's about 86 hospitalized patients, and that is down by 15. Hospitalized in intensive care units with COVID-19, statewide, there's about 269, and that's down by 6. Region 6, there's 47, that's down by 6. In Region 2, there's 12 with no change. Hospitalized on a ventilator with COVID-19, statewide, there's about 150, and that's down by 5. Region 6, there's 27, and that's down by 1. In Region 2, there's 8, no change. And then long-term care facility outbreaks. There's 150 outbreaks currently. It's up by 6. And it says, an outbreak is added when a facility has 3 or more residents test positive and removed when no new cases appear. So the LTC active outbreak cases, there's about 4,624. Percentage of statewide active cases, 4.9%, no change. LTC total outbreak deaths, 1,024. Percentage of statewide deaths, 45.1%, and that is down by 0.2%. And then in the state prisons, it says some numbers are self-reported. Anamosa State Penitentiary, inmates positive, 76, that's down by 7. Staff positive, 28, that's down by 5. Inmate COVID deaths, 5, that's up by 1. Clarinda Correctional Facility, inmates positive, 42, that's up by 8. Staff positive, 10, that's down by 5. Inmate COVID deaths, 1, no change. Fort Dodge Correctional Facility, inmates positive, 32, that's up by 2. Staff positive, 4, that's down by 2. Inmate COVID deaths, 3, that's no change. Iowa Correctional Institute for Women in Mitchellville, inmates positive, 0, that's down by 5. Staff positive, 1, no change. Inmate COVID deaths, 0, and staff COVID deaths, 1, no change. The next is the Iowa Medical Classification Center in Coralville. Inmates positive, 31, no change. Staff positive, 10, and that's down by 2. Inmate COVID deaths, 1, no change. Iowa State Penitentiary, Fort Madison. Inmates positive, 0, no change. Staff positive, 7, no change. Inmate COVID deaths, 0. Mount Pleasant Correctional Facility. Inmates positive, 10, no change. Staff positive, 11, no change. Inmate COVID deaths, 0. Newton Correctional Facility. Inmates positive, 5, and that's down by 6. Staff positive, 3, no change. Inmate COVID deaths, 0. North Central Correctional Facility, Rockwell City. Inmates positive, 10, that's up by 1. Staff positive, 9, that's up by 1. Inmate COVID deaths, 0. And then in Black Hawk County, the average 14-day average of COVID-19 cases. And today, let's see, it's showing about 130. And it says cases, 10,598. Average new cases per day, 160 plus 3. Oh, that's up 3 is what I mean. People currently infected, 4,549. That's up by 34. Hospitalized, 69. That's up by 5. 131 deaths. Average deaths per day, 1.5. And that's up by 0.3. And the fatality rate is 1.2%. There's no change. And the total population currently infected is about 3.5%. And that's increased by 0.1%. Total population ever infected, is 8.6%, and that's increased by 0.2%. Positive testing rate in the past 14 days is 19.7%, and that's down by 0.7%. And it says, Iowa school districts may request a temporary waiver to send students home for 14 days and move all instruction online if this metric is above 15% and if 10% of students are absent. And now we'll move to the long-term care facility outbreaks. So there are 7, and that's up by 1. So the Deary Suites at Western Home in Cedar Falls, this one was added November 25th. There are 9 cases and 0 recovered. Added November 24th, North Crest Specialty Care in Waterloo, 2 cases, no change, 0 recovered. Added November 20th, LaPorte City Specialty Care, 21 cases, no change, 0 recovered. Added November 20th, Pinnacle Specialty Care in Cedar Falls, 40 cases, no change, and 22 recovered, also no change. Added November 6th, Cedar Falls Health Center, 40 cases, no change, 3 recovered, so that has improved by 2. Added October 29th, Manor Care Health Services in Waterloo, there are 38 cases, no change, and 15 recovered, it's increased by 1. Added October 19th, Ravenwood Specialty Care in Waterloo, there are 140 cases, no change, and 70 recovered, plus 3. Now looking at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls, for the week of November 16th through 22nd, it says info is updated Mondays and Fridays at noon, forwardtogether.uni.edu/COVID-19-board contains the cases. New positive test at Student Health Center, there's been 73, and that's down by 8. Positive testing rate is 20.39%, and that is down by 8.33%. Number of self-reported cases may also be counted among the health center tests. That's 48, so that's up by 16. Number in isolation, those testing positive or displaying symptoms, less than 6, so there's no change. Number in quarantine, those exposed without symptoms, 49, and that is down by 9. And then the Hawkeye Community College, Waterloo, week of November 16th through 22nd, and it says this info is updated weekly at hawkeyecollege.edu/COVID-19-board. Numbers are self-reported. New student cases, there has been 29, and that's down by 5. Percentage of students positive is 0.79%, that's down by 0.14%. New employee cases, 3, that's down by 7. Percentage of employees positive is 0.41%, and that's down by 0.96%. And now looking at the reported cases by zip code as a percentage of total county cases, it says this is updated periodically. Cedar Falls, so the 50613 zip code, is 31.1%, so that's up by 0.7%. Dunkerton is 50626 zip code, and that's 1%. There's been no change. Elk Run Heights in Raymond, that's the 50667 zip code, 0.5%, no change. Evansdale, 50707 zip code, 5.7%, no change. Gilbertville, 50634, and that is 0.7%, no change. Hudson, 50643, and that is 1.6%, and that is up by 0.2%. Jessup, 50648, 0.8%, and that is up by 0.1%. LaPorte City, 50651 is the zip code, and that is 2.3%, and that is up by 0.2%. Waterloo, 50701, is 22.4% of the cases, and that is down by 0.4%. Waterloo, 50702, is 18.2% of the cases, and that is down by 0.4%. Waterloo, 50703, 14.4% of the cases, and that is down by 0.3%. The other 1.3%, and that is down by 0.1%. And reported cases by age 0 to 18 is 8.5%, and that is up by 0.3%. 19 to 39, 45.3%, that's down by 0.5%. 40 to 59, 27%, no change. 60 to 79, 15.3%, that is up by 0.1%. And the 80 plus demographic, 3.8%, and that is no change. Reported cases by sex, male 48.8%, and that is down by 0.2%. Female 51.2%, that is up by 0.2%. Reported cases by race, Asian 3.5%, and that is down by 0.1%. And it says the percentage of county population 2.5%, the racial disparity overrepresented by 1%. Black 12.5%, and that is down by 0.39%. Percentage of county population 9.7%, racial disparity overrepresented by 2.8%. Native Hawaiian slash Pacific Islander is 0.8%, no change. Percentage of the county population 0.4%, racial disparity overrepresented by 0.4%. White 81.4%, and that is up by 0.68%. 68%. Percentage of the county population is 84.5%. Racial disparity underrepresented by 3.1%. The other is 1.8%, and that is down by 0.1%. The reported cases by ethnicity, Hispanic slash Latinx, 8.8%, and that is down by 0.3%. The percentage of the population is 4.6%, and the racial disparity is overrepresented by 4.2%. So that is our COVID information for the area for today. I'm going to move to another news article. This one is titled, Man Arrested in TV Burglary in Cedar Falls. And this is by Jeff Reinitz. Cedar Falls, a Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly stealing a TV from a woman's basement while she was home. Police said Patrick Orlando Cannon Jr., 22, had noticed the 50-inch TV when he was in the Terrace Drive home working for a plumbing company November 6, and then returned after dark to remove the TV. The woman noticed the TV missing and called police November 10. Officers later recovered the TV and the remote. Cannon was arrested November 16 for second-degree burglary and was released pending trial. Court records show Cannon was sentenced to probation in February on a third-degree theft charge for allegedly taking $1,400 in cash from a cart at the Isle Hotel Casino in Waterloo in October 2019. At the time, Cannon was a security guard and was escorting an attendant who was filling tickets redemption kiosk at the casino, records state. The next article is titled, Hawkeye Community College COVID-19 Cases Decline as More Classes Move Online. And this is by Andrew Wind. Waterloo. Hawkeye Community College's COVID-19 cases declined last week as most lecture classes moved online for the rest of the semester. A total of 32 students and employees told Hawkeye that they tested positive for the virus between November 16th and November 22nd, the college reported Wednesday. That's a drop from 44 people from the previous week. Numbers of cases at the college have been growing since early October. The college posts weekly updates on those who self-report positive and presumed positive tests through an online dashboard at hawkeyecollege.edu/COVID-19. Hawkeye had announced in an update on its website that starting November 16th, students in lecture-based classes would move to remote delivery via Zoom, video conferencing, or other online applications. That will continue until the semester ends December 17th. For the past week, 29 of those testing positive were students, and 3 were Hawkeye employees. The dashboard notes the student number is 0.79% of the college's enrollment, and the employees represent 0.41% of its staff. Since August 24th, 291 students and staff have reported a positive test. That includes 247 students and 44 employees. You are listening to the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for November 26th. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Our first obituary today is for Denny Antrim. Denny was born June 17th, 1959, and died November 14th, 2020. Denny Antrim, 61, of Waterloo, died of natural causes on November 14th, 2020, at Mercy One Waterloo Medical Center. Graveside services will be at Garden of Memory Cemetery, Waterloo, on November 30th at 1:30 p.m. Haggerty Wachoff Grerup Funeral Service in Waterloo is assisting with arrangements. Denny attended River Hills School in Cedar Falls. After graduation, he participated in the Key program, which he was later named North Star Community Services. Denny received residential support from exceptional persons along with supported employment, dayhab, and guardianship, PPI. His last home was shared with three of his friends. Denny enjoyed shopping, fishing, watching Hallmark movies, and always liked to be helpful. Denny was very friendly, and people that knew him would say his smile lit up the room. Denny will be missed by all that knew him. Denny was preceded in death by his parents. Our next obituary is for Mary Canfield. Mary E. Canfield, she was born May 22nd, 1911, and passed away November 23rd, 2020. Mary E. Canfield was born May 22nd, 1911, in Claremore, Oklahoma, the daughter of Edward and Vita, formerly Elmore Holloway. She attended Northeast Missouri State Teachers College in Kirksville and belonged to Phi Kappa Sigma. Mary married Elmer Canfield on May 2nd, 1937. He preceded her in death October 18th, 1992. She served as deputy recorder of the Adair County, Missouri. Mary worked as a receptionist and bookkeeper at various hospitals and states which they lived, including Allen and Schweitz. She loved crafting and belonged to many organizations: Amaranth, Daughters of the American Revolution, White Shrine, Eastern Star, Bosent, Daughters of Nile, and Rebecca's, which she held state and national officer positions. Mary passed away November 23, 2020, at Pinnacle Specialty Care at the age of 109. She is preceded in death by her parents, husband, a daughter, Betty Sad, and three brothers, Rex, Herschel, and Ernest Holloway. Mary is survived by her son, Jim, married to Pat Canfield of Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin, five grandchildren, Donna, married to Larry White, Randy, married to Beth Sad, Tammy, married to Chris Goodwin, Alyssa, married to Scott Santowski, and Andy, married to Jessica Pagel, and 15 great-grandchildren, 12 great-great-grandchildren, and one great-great-great-grandchild. Visitation will be at Parrot and Wood, 965 Home Plaza, on Sunday, November 29th, from 2 to 4 p.m. 15 people are limited inside the funeral home, and masks are required. Services will be at Parrot and Wood, 965 Home Plaza, on Monday, November 30th, at 11 a.m. Burial will be at Garden of Memories. Parrot and Wood is handling arrangements. 319-232-3235. Condolences may be left at www.parrotandwood.com. And now I will move to our next obituary. This one is for Dwayne Kraft. He was born August 24th, 1932, and passed away on November 23rd, 2020. LaPorte City, Dwayne Kraft, 88, of LaPorte City, died Monday, November 23rd, 2020, at his home. He was born August 24th, 1932, in LaPorte City, the son of Clyde E. and Norma Christian Kraft. He was a 1950 graduate of LaPorte City High School. He married Joanne Wilt on October 25th 1953 at the Episcopal United Methodist Church in La Porte City. Duane farmed in La Porte City and surrounding areas for many years. He was a member of Delta Tau Delta at ISU, Iowa Corn Growers Association, where he was master corn grower for a year. He had a love of nature and could recognize every tree and plant. He loved to take old farms and make them new. Survived by his wife, Joanne of La Porte City, a son, Alan, married to Joyce Craft of La Porte City, two daughters, Deborah, married to Lee Rottinghouse of Jessup, Angela, married to Mike Reinert of Cedar Falls, 13 grandchildren, Ryan, married to Holly Moser, Rottinghouse, Mindy, married to Ling Heng Yi, Rottinghouse, Brianna, Rottinghouse, Lucas, Cheyenne, married to Cheyenne Dean, Rottinghouse, Andrea, Rottinghouse, Daniel, married to Jennifer Gardner, Kraft, Laura, married to Alan Mast, Christopher, married to Annie Kraft, Matthew, married to Andrea Reinert, Jennifer, married to Samuel Renning, Amy, married to Benjamin Gross, Jonathan Reinert, and 14 great-grandchildren, William, Jackson, Isaac, Oliver, Briar, Hindley, Willa, Finn, Aaron, Adrian, Liam, Nolan, Nora, and Margaret, preceded in death by his parents, a sister, Diane Mether, and grandson, Benjamin Rottinghouse. Private family graveside services will be held in the Westview Cemetery. A video of the service will be posted to the funeral home website. Memorials may be directed to St. Paul United Methodist Church, La Porte City. La Porte City Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. 319-342-3131. Online condolences may be left at www.kernsfuneralservice.com. Our next obituary is for Keith Brown. Keith W. Brown, Cedar Falls. Keith W. Brown, 82, of Cedar Falls, died Tuesday, November 24th, 2020, at Unity Point Health Allen Hospital in Waterloo. Services are pending at this time with Locke Funeral Home. Locke Funeral Home's number is 319-233-6138. And now we move to our next obituary. This obituary is for Joseph Hinders. Joseph, also known as Joe F. Hinders. Joseph, known as Joe F. Hinders, age 40, of Clarksville, Iowa, died Sunday, November 22nd, 2020, at Waverly Health Center in Waverly, Iowa, from natural causes. Graveside services will be 11 a.m. Saturday, November 28th, at the Linwood Cemetery in Clarksville. Mass and social distancing are mandatory. Memorials may be directed to the family. Redmond Schwartz Funeral Home in Clarksville is in charge of arrangements. Online condolences may be left at www.redmond-schwartz.com. The next obituary is for Judith Keeler. Judith, who also goes by Judy Keeler from Waterloo. Judith, also known as Judy Keeler, 79, of Waterloo, died Monday, November 23rd, 2020, at North Crest Specialty Care in Waterloo. Services are pending at this time with Locke Funeral Home. Locke Funeral Home's number is 319-233-6138. The next obituary is for Judith Kotke. Judith A. Kotke. She was born August 21st, 1945, and passed away November 22nd, 2020. Judith, also known as Judy Ann Kotke, 75, of Fredericksburg, passed away on Sunday, November 22nd, 2020, at Hillcrest Home in Summer. A graveside service will be held at 2 o'clock on Wednesday, November 25th, 2020, at St. John's Cemetery in Boyd, Iowa, with a celebration of life gathering to follow in the spring if possible. Due to state and federal guidelines on gatherings regarding the COVID-19 pandemic, social distancing is required. Those in attendance are required to wear a mask. S.K. Rogers Funeral Home in Summer is in charge of arrangements. Judy was born on August 21st, 1945, to Neil and Lorraine, formerly Tobin Ernest. She attended country school and then the Turkey Valley up until her senior year at Fredericksburg High School, where she graduated in 1963. Judy was united in marriage on November 27, 1965, to Eugene Kottke at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Catholic Church in Lawler, Iowa. She worked as the activity director at Sunrise Guest Home in Fredericksburg for many years. She then worked for Rockwell and Sumner, where she so loved both her job and co-workers until her MS would no longer allow. Judy was a member of the J-Sets, a CCD teacher for the St. Frederick's Catholic Church, and a den mother for the Boy Scouts of America. She and Eugene were also longtime members of a local card club made up of a fun group of lifelong friends. She enjoyed very much spending time with her family, especially Sunday drives to the river with a loaf of bread and a pack of circle meat for the road. Judy was a talented crafter and artist. She painted many pictures and even drew the picture for a Fredericksburg Butter Factory commemorative plate. She also loved dolls and making dolls, including handmade Cabbage Patch style dolls that gained her front page news in the Fredericksburg Review. Judy will be missed by many. Her kindness, laughter, and sense of humor rarely went unnoticed by anyone around her. Judy is survived by her children. Kelly, married to Brian Schaffenbuehl of Sumner. Corey, married to Sherry Kottke of Carmichael's, Pennsylvania. And Cody, fiancé of Jennifer Lassinen of Sumner. Siblings, Mick, married to Teresa Ernest, Rose Schroyer of Fredericksburg, and Tom Ernest of Newton, Wisconsin. 7 grandchildren and 1 great-grandchild. She was preceded in death by her husband, parents, sister-in-law, Jill Ernest, and brother-in-law, John Schroyer. Now I will move to our sports section for today. Our first article is Waterloo East basketball coach Carmichael focuses on building relationships. Waterloo. When Brent Carmichael returned to Cedar Valley last summer, he carried with him a college lesson learned nearly 4 decades prior to his arrival in Waterloo. Waterloo East incoming boys basketball coach has spent the past few months building relationships with players, their families, and members of the community. When you want to build a program, I think you have to have all those entities tied together, Carmichael said. You have got to have the players buy into the program that you want to present to them, and then you've got to have the parents also being able to trust you with their children. Then you also need the community to get behind your school to show support for the kids they're appreciated for what they're doing. It's an approach Carmichael learned from former University of Northern Iowa basketball coach Jim Barry's in the early 80s. Coach Barry was very passionate about his players, Carmichael recalls. He spent time with us, not just at practice. We would sit down and have conversations about pretty much everything under the sun. That was probably the thing I needed most as a young man coming in and playing Division I basketball, was just being able to learn to trust the coach because I didn't know what to expect. While the COVID-19 pandemic has presented communication challenges, Carmichael was able to reach out to a variety of people electronically. Connecting players of today with those who walked in their shoes in the past is one of his priorities. Carmichael takes over a position previously occupied by Hall of Fame coach Steve McGraw, who compiled a 629-375 record over a 46-year coaching career that included 514-273 mark at East. The Trojans basketball program boasts 3 state championship and 4 runner-up finishes. The players, they're very passionate about basketball, Carmichael said. This community is rich in basketball, especially East High with all the history that came through here. A lot of the former players, alumni, have called and expressed their congratulations to me being picked as the head coach, but also to give me some insight on what it took for them to be successful. It was nice to get to know a lot of the alumni and hear some of the stories of the past. One of the things I want to do is connect our players of today with those players of the past, because they need to know the history and foundation of the program they're going to be involved in. Carmichael, who set UNI's career steals records in 3 seasons, plans to have his team prepared to play a full court pressure defense while also mixing in a variety of looks on the end of that court. Our primary will be defense, he said. We're going to be hard-nosed on defense. Following a 5-year professional basketball career that included time with Southern California, Summer Pro League, the Continental Basketball Association, and international competition in the Philippines and Guam, one of Carmichael's mentors introduced him coaching. John Perez, who started a grade school football program in Carmichael's East Moline, Illinois neighborhood, and also first taught him how to play basketball, reached out to Carmichael after Carmichael moved back to the Quad Cities from Denver in 1999. Perez called and asked Carmichael if he'd coach his son's AAU team. Carmichael eventually started his own AAU program that ran for 6 years. He then coached at Riverdale High School in Port Byron, Illinois, from 2003 to 2008, before spending 5 years coaching in Texas. Most recently, Carmichael worked as an assistant at Ellsworth Community College. Throughout his lengthy coaching career, Carmichael taken pride in continuing to be available for his players following their tenure in his program. The one thing I tell every player that I've ever coached is that once I coach, you're always mine, Carmichael said. To this day, I have kids who are in their 30s that still call me and want to know what's going on with me or may need a recommendation letter, or if I'm doing a camp or clinic, they want to be involved. As his first game at East nears, Carmichael has enjoyed the initial practices. They're good kids, Carmichael said. I've had a really good time with them, being able to talk and share and let them know a little bit about me and get to know them from a personal standpoint. Our next article is ISU Football. Newell is Cyclones leader up front. This is by Ben Visser, a sports correspondent. Ames. Iowa State has taken the nation's leading rusher in Breece Hall, and quarterback Brock Purdy has taken a few sacks in the Big 12. Those two playmakers get the headlines, but the big fellas up front need to get some credit where it's due. Coach Matt Campbell has talked about how left tackle Sean Foster has revitalized his career in his senior season, and how junior left guard Derek Schweiger has filled in well for the injured Trevor Downing. He's also talked about the two freshmen on the right side of the line, Daryl Simmons and Jake Rumsberg, and the job they've done as young players. But Colin Newell has steadily and quietly led Iowa State offensive line into becoming one of the best lines in the Big 12. He's the anchor, Campbell said of the Ames native. Colin is a really special young man. He's a young man that is an incredible leader. He's a young man that has loved Iowa State from the first day that I had the opportunity to meet him. One of the best things that I knew about Colin is Colin would someday become the best version of himself that he could be. That path took a bit of a detour last season when he was a sophomore. Newell got hurt in Iowa State's first game of the season. He was coming off of what would have been a really good redshirt freshman year. He started every game at center, and then to lose him and miss a season, that's hard, Campbell said. And now I'm just so impressed with not just how he came back from the injury, but how he's been able to lead and demand a sense of consistency and demand a sense of standard within that offensive line room. I think Colin's a young man that's held that standard from the day he's been back, and really from January on, and I think what's happened is a lot of those guys have risen to his level of success and preparation. Iowa State fans are beginning to see the best version of Newell looks like. Running back Breece Hall sees it too. However, he doesn't see it for very long before he bursts through the hole that Newell helped open up for him. He means everything to this offense, Hall said. He's the one that corrects everybody on the offensive line, makes all the calls, sets the protection, and everything like that. Having him is a big help. He's one of the smartest guys on the offense. He's always knows what to do. He calls out the mic points in the run. He helps everyone out everywhere. Campbell thought Newell would have a veteran running mate this season to help him guide the young and inexperienced players on the line and Trevor Dowling. But Downing got hurt in Iowa State's first game, so it's been all Newell guiding the line. He was that guy before Trevor went down, Campbell said. There were two of them, but that's just what I love about Colin Newell. It's that there's been no change in Colin Newell. You've just seen growth. He's always demanded the best of himself. And he's cared so much that he's had this unique ability, even as a young player, to demand the best of others around him. Obviously, it was great to have a partner in crime in Trevor to start the season, with the experience that Trevor had. But that's what I love about Colin. He's been the same guy every day, and I think that's why you see him playing at such a high rate for us. There's another article about Iowa State to finish us off for sports. This article is titled, Iowa's Offensive Line Striving to Be More Greedy. This is by Steve Batterson. Really, it's nothing personal. Alaric Johnson and Tyler Linderbaum and the rest of the Iowa offensive line believe it is better for Keith Duncan to be seen on the sideline and not heard from the field. That's especially true whenever the Hawkeyes move the ball inside the 20-yard line. We love Keith to death, but when he leads the nation in red zone field goals, that means we're not doing our job the best we can, Linderbaum said. That has been a point of emphasis going back to the preseason for Iowa, working to generate enough offense to score touchdowns and not settle for field goals. Iowa settled a lot on its way to a 10-3 record last season as Duncan connected on a Big Ten record 29 field goals. Of those, 16 came during the 42 drives the Hawkeyes had reached inside the opponent's 20-yard line. While 3 points were nice, Iowa's preferences remains to collect 6. The emphasis has been on when we get to the red zone, to push it on through and get that touchdown, Linderbaum said. We seem to be doing a better job with that. Iowa rushed for 14 touchdowns on drives that extended into the red zone in 2019. It took the Hawkeyes 5 games to top that figure this season. All 15 of the Hawkeyes rushing touchdowns heading into Friday's noon game against Nebraska have come on plays snapped in the red zone. Iowa's longest touchdown run during its 3-2 start was a 15-yard carry by Tyler Goodson in the game against Northwestern. 6 of the scores have come on carries of 1 yard, including 3 by Mekhi Sargent. The most recent came on a 3-yard quarterback sneak by Spencer Petras, which gave Iowa a 31-70 lead midway through the third quarter of last Saturday's victory at Penn State. The Iowa sophomore, who has scored twice this season on sneaks, knows where the credit belongs. It's the guys up front, Petras said. It's not me, I'll tell you that much. I'm not the strongest of the litter. It's just a great job up front getting a push. I'll take those guys against anyone. Linderbaum said the objective isn't exactly rocket science, although it does require effective teamwork. Just get lower than your man and keep driving your feet. Just try to push your man as far back as you can, and if you end up in the end zone, your man ends up in the end zone. The results are going to be pretty good. Petras said Iowa's newfound red zone success began long before the Hawkeyes kicked off their season opener in Purdue in late October. It starts with great preparation, Petras said. All the guys working in the trenches. We expect effort and toughness. That's what we're about. And when you get the ball down there, you have to push it like we have. Offensive tackle Alaric Johnson said the cohesion online has made a difference in the Hawkeyes' ability to rebound from the team's 0-2 start to win its last 3 games. It shows in Iowa's rushing total, averaging 212 yards during the win streak it carries into Friday's noon matchup with Nebraska at Kinnick Stadium. It shows in the Hawkeyes' red zone production. In each of victories in Iowa's last 3 games, the Hawkeyes have rushed for 4 touchdowns, the longest 14-yard run by Sargent that completed Iowa's scoring at Minnesota. We're working together as a unit, Jackson said. Day by day, we're putting in work and we become really tight as a group. Everyone is doing their job. And that, Jackson said, leads to the desired destination. This year, we've worked hard to figure things out and get the ball into the end zone, Jackson said. We're putting a priority on getting touchdowns instead of field goals. We like it a lot more when Keith Duncan is on the sideline watching us put the ball in the end zone. We'd rather see that than him on the field. Really, it's nothing personal. Just trying to do our job, Jackson said. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. I am your reader, Katie Carlton. Thank you so much for listening.
Roxanne Watson is on a mission.
Hello, how are you doing today?
She wants more people to register as organ, eye, and tissue donors.
Are you an organ donor?
Yes, I am.
Yay! Ready.
My goal is to sign up the most people in the United States.
What drives her? Roxanne's own life was saved through the gift of a heart transplant, made possible by an organ donor.
I decided that day that I was going to devote myself to the cause of organ donation and signing people up and honoring my donor by doing that.
Now she's back to health, and she's a powerful force helping to save lives every day through her work. Imagine what you can make possible by leaving behind the gift of life.
8 people can be helped with the major organs, and up to 50 people can be helped with a little bit of everything. And when you think about it that way, that you could help that many people, it's amazing, it really is.
Learn more and sign up as an organ, eye, and tissue donor. Go to organdonor.gov. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.